Preparing for this talk with you this evening, I came across, in fact, I looked for a file that said Museum Help. And reading through its forgotten pile of correspondence, I was reminded how large a role this museum played in our being here tonight. Now, some of you may remember the early days of the museum, and I can't see how many of you can remember. But at any rate, this museum went through that early era when there was no outside board of directors, when there was no recruited membership, and when its brilliant and tenaciously devoted founder, Harold Hochschild, still retained a very strong hand in its affairs. Well, then remember, too, that publishing under its own imprint was one of its avowed missions, producing distinctive books about the Adirondacks, handsomely printed. Well, one Sunday afternoon in the summer of 1964, a young man named Warder Cadbury, whom some of you have heard of, scouting for the museum, showed up at Wendover, our family place. And at the beach, we were watching the children swim. Looking out, he said, for the Hudnut who writes. And so he said, but even more, he was in search of information about an area and a great camp about which they at the museum, and particularly Mr. Hochschild, knew very little. My guess is that they had seen William Wessel's little paperback called Adirondack Profiles. I don't know whether any of you have seen that. It was published in 1961. And I think they may have had an inkling of what Fox Lair was about from that and just were curious. They sent Warder over. Eventually, it's too long a tale to tell now about the book situation, but because that's what Warder was hoping to get, because I had written a book earlier, and so at that time I was the Hudnut who writes. So eventually I did write the book about the Adirondacks, but far more important on that day began our valued friendship with the museum, particularly with the Hochschilds, with the Hochschild family and my family, the incredible help of Mr. Swinney, who was one of the early directors, and Dr. Inverarity, and the wonderful William Verner, who knew a great deal about writing books, and my correspondence with him tells me that. But most of all, the long bond with Warder Cadbury over the years. When my Adirondack archive was finally published in 1993 by North Country Books, after having been laid aside for some 30 years, Warder wrote a beautiful appreciation for it that my publisher used, and I truly believe that he helped its sales to flourish and even keeps it modestly alive 15 years later. What he wrote was that something like this, tracing a family's trail through Adirondack history for more than six generations, from the pre-revolutionary settlement of Sir William Johnson at Fish House on the Sacandaga, to the guides northward at Perkins Clearing, and to the glories of Fox Lair and the staying powers of Wendover. Well, writing that book was a piece of work for me. The Adirondack Museum was in transition, and the Syracuse University Press was taking over the publishing. So they were not free. Mr. Hochschild was not free to say, he did want the book published, but he was not free to have that happen. And not only that, I found out that some of my beloved older generation at Wendover disagreed about certain things that they had told me about and that I had written about, but they didn't want to have published. And so I just got a little discouraged, put it on a shelf, and 30 years later, picked it up. Anyway, it was a piece of work. And while I know that expectations are tonight more focused on Foxlair and the Valentino visit, I'm going to take the liberty of using a bit of its frame of my book's framework, because as Bill Verner said to me in one of our little sessions, and when we were still trying to publish that book for the museum, he said, what you have here is a fascinating tale of two brothers. And I couldn't tell it to you any other way, so here we go. Richard Hudnut, born in 1855, died in 1629. William, 10 years younger, my grandfather, 1865 born, died in 1963 when he was almost 100. They were as different as two brothers could possibly be. And yet, unbeknownst to the other, by separate paths, they came to the same remote area of the Adirondacks. They built their own individual Adirondack legends 10 miles from each other. That is a pretty amazing coincidence. Of course, it wasn't a coincidence, but we do not know how they came there together. So it's the story about two brothers, but there's a minor theme too, which is a celebration or an elegy for lost places. You'll see a few pictures of these places dear to our history, now long gone or left behind. The beautiful village of Fish House, much of it literally drowned by the coming of the Sacandaga Reservoir. Camp Perkins, legendary fishing camp built by Isaiah Perkins, destroyed by the state of New York. And Foxlair, the only great camp. We didn't call it a great camp in those days, but we take that word from books by the Adirondack Museum. The only great camp in our unknown part of the Adirondacks, burned to the ground, every bit of it. So, a litany of lost places is my minor theme. But first, the two brothers, Richard, William, two sons of the same father, their mothers, sisters, in a large family. They were 10 years apart, and while they grew up in the same elaborate homes, in New York and Llewellyn Park, and with every privilege known to growing boys, Llewellyn Park, and with every privilege known to growing boys, their lives and personalities were poles apart. Their father was Alexander Hudnut, a self-made pharmacist whose drugstores in New York, one at Herald Square, where Macy's stands now. Alexander made his fortune, a very large one indeed, while he was relatively young and in the days before income tax. Among other profitable accomplishments, at least according to him, he invented the ice cream soda. And they say that you could see on a hot evening in New York, you could see people lined up all the way around the block to get it. His entrepreneurial skills in marketing and business practice laid a groundwork and greatly enabled the career of his son Richard, who has been called the father of the cosmetic industry in America and in this country. But he was also the father of American-made perfume, which I only realized very lately because I found another article in that museum folder that I found. And that tells me that before Uncle Richard, people didn't buy American perfumes. They weren't made. Anybody who might make them would have to get their oils and the things that created perfume over in France, possibly some in England, parts of England. At any rate, Richard was primarily a perfumer, known even today by connoisseurs for the fragrances that he created and the beautiful bottles that he designed and commissioned from such houses as Lalique and Baccarat, often inlaid with labels of engraved copper set into the glass And then these bottles would be boxed in silk and velvet, leather, a really remarkable collection that is made, that if you ever went to one of the national meetings of something that I belonged to for a while called the International Perfume Bottle Association, people pay exquisite prices for these things. And I started making a collection and then decided that it was out of my league. His achievement in the realm of beauty preparations was to make them, as we might say today, respectable. Uncle Richard believed that all elegant women, not just actresses and the demi-monde, should be free to enhance themselves with makeup. And I say amen. His luxurious, I've never known how to do it, but I know that it's a very great thing for women to be able to enhance nature a little bit. His luxurious salons and beautiful packages, as well as the first beauty and exercise classes to be held in anything like a public place of this sort, built him a fortune, and a fortune upon his father's fortune, which he would inherit. And that began to trickle down to our remote part of the Adirondacks about the last decade of the 19th century. And this was a region that was at that time reached only by train to North Creek, and from there by carriage on a rough dirt road that wound round Sodom and Baker's Mills to the long valley known as Oregon, along the east branch of the Sacandaga River. The beauty of that long valley really has to be seen to be believed, I believe. Because here was the long valley with the Sacandaga River, the East Branch, wandering through in a very lazy, curvaceous way, and framed on both sides as it goes down by some of the area's most beautiful mountains, Black Mountain, Big and Little Hopkins, Square Falls Mountain, and the majestic 11th Mountain, which we also can see the back of from Wendover. We don't know how he first, I missed a paragraph. In this valley, there had been profitable lumbering since the 1870s, and a tannery had been built there to make use of the bark of the trees that were cut down. In 1890, that tannery burned to the ground. And by the time, soon after that, when Uncle Richard first saw Oregon, only a few small, struggling farms remained in a valley that had supported a village and a sizable workforce. We don't know how he first came there. What we do know is that before 1900, he set about buying the whole valley, one little farm after another, the tannery lot, the schoolhouse lot, the funeral lot, and about 1904, he felt that he had bought most everything. It was called the acquisition period in my consciousness. And at that time, he could begin to build the big house, build his own houses. The land was his. And as the families who had lived there departed, Oregon became a ghost town. Richard's final holdings of just over 1,200 acres were completely surrounded by state land, so that it gave it on the map, it would give the impression of a much, much larger estate, although 1,200 acres isn't too bad. At any rate, most of the buildings of the village were then destroyed, torn down, burned, carted away, and as the foundations were filled in, leveled and planted, the shape of Richard's mountain kingdom appeared. This would be known as Fox Lair. In its days of glory, it was one of the great estates of the Adirondacks, the only great camp in our entire region, in the far corner of the township of Johnsburg, county of Warren, And yet, even then, like Oregon, so remote and isolated that it was virtually unknown. And now a little bit about William, 10 years younger, part of my great-grandfather's second family by a lovely second wife. Her name was Mariah Parker, and she was the younger sister of Richard's mother. Richard's mother had died early of a tragic case of typhoid fever, leaving three children, Richard the oldest. As Richard was therefore the hero worship, the hero worshipped older brother of William and his small family, and the small family of four, the second family that he was a part of. Richard was intensely creative. He was introverted and very cold of temperament, and an extremely self-involved person with an ego luckily matched by his fortune, because how can you imagine taking a whole long valley and making it your own? At any rate, William was rather different. He had a warm and sensitive nature. He was a generous, affectionate center of that second family of three boys and one girl. After graduating from Exeter, he went to Princeton University, where he came under the strong Presbyterian influence there, much as Harvard in the same 1880s was under a Unitarian influence and Yale, very Episcopalian. So William left the Episcopal Church of his heritage and his family and enrolled at non-denominational Union Seminary in New York to study for the ministry in the Presbyterian Church. Union Seminary then, as now, was known for its rigorous and liberal theology, and I take great delight in the fact that today the senior prize for the best preaching is given in his name. The Hudnut summer home, Alexander Hudnut's summer home, was at Seabright on the New Jersey shore. But during the years that Richard was a grown young man, but came with the family, and William was growing up, they came as a family up to Saratoga for the races and the summer sociability, staying at the great United States Hotel with its porch so famously high and long, with its passing parade of elegant visitors who changed their clothes, I understand, two or three times a day. That was not William's idea of what the Adirondacks should be. And so as often as he could beg the passage from his parents, he was able to take the stagecoach north to Raybrook for a day or so, where he fished with the guides and developed a lifelong love for the Adirondack wilderness. Because of a persistent illness in his first year at seminary, a summer of recuperation was spoken of by the doctor, and he had just exactly the place he wanted to go, which was the Adirondack Preserve Association, also called the Preserve, the Fish and Game Preserve. And so he was given a membership by his father, which cost $100. And that was, and I rather imagine back in 1886, which this was, I rather imagine that was more than what we would think $100 would be today. At any rate, the club then owned some 4,000 acres in Minerva, with seven lakes on the property. Anyway, William's father paid the membership fee. I don't know why I have that in there twice. It must have seemed important. He went by way of a train to North Creek, then by stagecoach to Minerva, walking the rest of the way about 10 miles. By his own account, it was a wonderful summer. He enjoyed the company of members. One, the artist Eliphalet Taylor, Terry. I don't know whether I pronounced that correctly. I think it could be Eliphalet. At any rate, the artist Eliphalet Terry. And of course, Winslow Homer was a member of the, oh, this became the Northwoods Club. I should have mentioned that instead of the other thing. It became the Northwoods Club some years later. So the grandfather was a founding member, but one of the first members, rather, but only of the APA, the association. His first summer internship before senior year at Union was by fortunate circumstance at the Little Red Presbyterian Church at Fish House, a sweet village in the foothills of the Adirondacks, where, as I told you, Sir William Johnson had had his fish house, where he went to hunt and fish. And as you know, he was the great commissioner of Indian affairs for King George. Here William met the daughter of the leading parishioner, James Fuller Beecher, who was a cousin, a distant cousin, of the famous 19th century family of preachers and writers and social activists. And William fell in love with Harriet, who was named, no doubt, for the celebrated cousin, Harriet Beecher Stowe. They were married the following summer, 1890, in beautiful Fish House. And the Beecher home there would be the scene of their summer holidays for years to come. William took Harriet to Raybrook for their honeymoon, and although their growing young family would be devoted to their summers at Fish House, William himself was always itching to go higher and deeper in search of wilderness and trout streams and a more rustic life. So, the single photographs of Grandfather that you'll see tonight at the Association to Preserve the Adirondacks in our family archives is a kind of prelude for the way that he would settle Harriet and the children in at Fish House in later years and let them stay with the Beecher grandparents for a few weeks while he went off for a happy life to Camp Perkins with his fishing rod and rod and reel and a backpack and a few friends who wanted to come with him. Isaiah Perkins was the subject of so many of my father's tall tales and my grandfather's favorite guide and a Northwoods host beyond compare. His huge and plainly rugged log cabin was legend in the first decades of the 20th century in that area. Here, for example, the young mayor of New York City, John Curoy Mitchell, brought his bride for a much publicized honeymoon. And partly this was the vivid character of the family there. Isaiah himself always seemed larger than life to my father. He was a huge, convivial, Albert Schweitzer-looking woodsman. His wife was a diminutive, convivial, very competent woman, descended from the Lawrence family, who once owned thousands of acres, grants from the English king, still on the tax maps of New York State as the Lawrence Tract. Much of it lost by then, but for the few parcels of land the Perkins owned around Speculator, one of which William and Harriet would buy from Isaiah, who would build them their first Adirondack home. It was a very camp-style camp with two stone fireplaces in it, and it was on a beautiful stretch of Lake Pleasant with sandy beach and a skyline of mountains. They called it Wamakita. And that's where I was taken as a baby of 3 months. And so you can see I've spent my summers in the Adirondacks. That was a long, long time ago. I take this time with Camp Perkins because it is the true wilderness note in my litany of lost places. Isaiah had built Camp Perkins on state land, close to his hunting and fishing wildernesses of the Jessup's River, the Cedar Lakes, the Canadas, and Louis Lake. French Louis, one of the most famous of the Adirondack guides and a greatly beloved friend of the Perkins family, was known to have camps hidden away in many choice locations. But, and many of the Adirondack guides did, and they differed all the way from a tiny lean-to to good-sized cabins. I've seen the ones, as I'm sure you have, with pots and pans hanging on the wall. And there they could store provisions for their hunting and fishing parties and make base camp for extended stays in the woods. Camp Perkins differed only in degree of size and in its established character as an inn, and the fact that it had for years supported a thriving, industrious family life. My father used to love to go there when he was old enough with his father, and they slept on the huge attic across the front of it. You'll see the picture of Camp Perkins, and Dad said that that's where they put many of the sports, as they called them, the men that were going up to fish, and he said that the snoring made a mighty chorus at night. At any rate, Camp Perkins had been built on New York State land, as I said, near the lakes that were important for the fishing, and it was built there by a practice under the shadow of a practice called squatters' rights. And this practice was abolished as the forest preserve became a fact and the interest in conservation emerged. Camp Perkins was ordered closed down and demolished. And this was a tragedy for all the guides. I think of the guides I've known up here. You think of the ones that you've known. I think of Earl Allen and Bert Robbins and others who must have had similar stashes up in the Siamese ponds. And writing this and knowing the sadness my family felt for the Perkins and other guides they had known, it is heartwarming to report that the site of Camp Perkins is memorialized now by an act of the state legislature named Perkins Clearing. You can find it on your map, so identified on the map of Hamilton County. Well, sometime before and during these years that my grandparents were building a family and settling at Wamakita, and William was moving steadily up the clerical ladder, Richard was building his perfume and cosmetic empire, acquiring elaborate homes in Greenwich, one called the Castle, renting a big house from Mrs. Vanderbilt one winter social season in New York. He didn't build the chateau at Juin-les-Pins on the French Riviera. He bought that, so the story goes, in the family from a very dispossessed Romanian queen. And he wanted it for many reasons, but mostly because it was near the perfume gardens, the flowers of grass. In 1920, I didn't tell you that his first wife, who was the one that really was with him for all the years of the building of Fox Lair, was the way that I saw it written, a woman of her own wealth. And her father was a man named Horace Beals, who owned the granite quarries up on Dix Island in Maine that built some of the great significant granite buildings of New York City, the courthouse and the post office and such things as that. At any rate, Evelyn Beals Hudnut was a woman to match her background. She was an enormous person and a great character, and she used to ride in her carriage into North Creek. She never got out of the carriage, and people looked at her, and her driver would go in and buy whatever it was that she needed, and she would look out at the people, and they would all, she would, just like Queen Elizabeth. At any rate, she was a character. And so when she died, this large woman, that my father said that she was really, in her own way, quite elegant. When he was a young man at Princeton, he used to go into the house that they would rent in New York City and for parties, and he said She was enormous, but she wore marvelous clothes for that kind of thing. You know, if you are very well financed, you can look very handsome when you're large too. And she dyed her hair, and when she had to have a conveyance or a certain kind of a seat built for her at Foxlair for the family, for her bathroom, the carpenter, and this is a story that is sort of, that was known throughout North Creek, the carpenter asked her to sit down, and she did. Very politely, he drew a circle around her. Well, I don't always tell that story, but I thought you might enjoy it. At any rate, in 1920, he had a new wife. His telegram to my grandparents when Evelyn died was, "The dear little one has passed away." In 1920, Richard had a new wife, a handsome, willowy California interior decorator who had been in business with the great Elsie DeWolf. In fact, she had been her sister-in-law, because Winifred had been married 3 times before Uncle Richard. She was a handsome woman. She was the granddaughter of Heber Kimball, Brigham Young's first lieutenant, and she was a Mormon of the Mormons. And in fact, I found out when I was in Salt Lake City one time that she had registered my grandfather and Uncle Richard in the Book of Mormons. So they are in the kind of, you have heard that that can be done. She did it. At any rate, she had been married to several, she'd been married twice before, and it turns out that her daughter from her first marriage was to bring Foxlair and its Adirondack neighborhood its single departure from a well-guarded privacy and anonymity. For that daughter, also by name Winifred Hudnut, she was adopted by Richard, was the gifted Hollywood designer, formerly a ballerina in the Alexandra Kozlov Ballet, with the stage name of Natasha Rambova. She became the second wife of Rudolph Valentino. Arguably, she might have been the only real wife of Valentino. It is too long and theatrically complicated a tale for me to recount here. It takes up a whole chapter in my book, but I will say I have enjoyed my years of studying their folklore and trying to imagine those two here in the Adirondacks on their honeymoon. After Rudy's much publicized mad dash across the country, train after train, always trying to look as if he wasn't Rudolph Valentino, but everybody knowing that he really was. While Natasha was imprisoned, as she put it, at Foxlair, where there was no phone, she was driven at least an hour those days on the little dirt road into North Creek Station each day to send long messages to her beloved. The telegraph operator let her use his special telephone, and it was couched in their private love language, actually baby talk, all to the delight of that telegraph operator and the listeners on the party line. When Valentino arrived at North Creek, he was whisked into Uncle Richard's limousine, and all along the road to Foxlair, little girls like Froni Montina, who told me about the thrill of it, they watched for ages just to finally see a long, low sports car with a bearded and deeply pulled down hat pass them in a cloud of dust. There have been so many speculations about the private lives of this celebrated pair. I have read all the biographies that I could possibly, I don't think there's a biography of Valentino that I haven't read. I really loved the one big and truly beautifully produced biography of Natasha Rambova by Michael Morris about 5 or 10 years ago. there's a large difference between the two, but I don't really know which it is. At any rate, I've read them, and I've, including their letters and the somewhat problematic messages from the beyond via their spiritualist guide and medium. And all there is time, and the true medium was Blackfeather, and the messages from Valentino to Natasha came via Blackfeather. And that was always a little difficult for us Presbyterians. But at any rate, it was very important to Natasha. And they are actually quite wonderful letters, many of them, and they're published in her own book that she published after Rudy's death. At any rate, no matter what either of their lives were like in the years apart, whether either or both were at one point or another in their lives gay, lesbian, bisexual, whatever, whether Valentino went wild in the year after Natasha left him and got engaged to Pola Negri, whether Natasha ever really loved the Italian count that she married on the rebound after Rudy died, whether any of those things, I don't really much care. And I certainly don't think there's enough to warrant the absolute certainties that so many people seem to have about the two. But at any rate, I believe, and I really feel that I know, that they were each other's greatest love, and that the happiest times they ever had, and maybe in their lives, as Valentino said, were those 2 weeks of the summer at Foxlair. I would like to mention that Natasha Rambova has finally been given her due in many women's studies programs in universities. She was a great designer. She had incredible skills. It is true that she was very autocratic and that she wanted always to have her own way, but that is the way with very brilliant artists very frequently, as you know. And she not only was a very great designer, but she did many other things. She acted not quite as successfully. She, by middle age, she became she studied the psychology of Carl Jung, was very interested in his work, and went over to his place in Switzerland, I think. And she became a heavy student of Egyptian art of all sorts. And she wrote three enormous books. They're, you know, this coffee table size, but I don't think the Bollingen Foundation would like them to be called coffee table books. But at any rate, they were published by the Bollingen Foundation. And there's a beautiful room in the University of Utah in the University Museum, which has the collections of Richard and Winifred Hudnut in it. And there, one of the rooms is a very beautiful room of Egyptian antiquities, which is called the Natasha Rambova Gallery. Now, we have no pictures of the Valentinos at Foxlair, which is why I have included a few of the chateau at Juan-les-Pins in the Riviera, where they spent a lot of time. They partied with the Fitzgeralds and the Hemingways, and I saw a wonderful picture of the Valentinos in Swimming with Picasso. After 1923, this lovely place, the chateau, was increasingly Richard and Winifred's chosen home. Richard died there in 1929. He had sold his business, having no heirs to carry it on. My father had been encouraged to do this, but his courses in chemistry at Princeton precluded any such prospects. The war had changed his life, the First World War, and his goals, but I can imagine that there were times in his ministerial life when he may have thought wistfully about the road not taken. Anyway, Uncle Richard sold the business a few years before his death. Fox Lair lay deserted. The Armstrongs, who had been the latest caretakers and were our dear, dear friends, and when I was there as a child, I loved going over to their caretaker's house and the barns, and they were wonderful, dear friends of our families. The Armstrongs still in the caretaker's house, keeping everything perfect, as if the family was going to fly across the ocean and arrive that coming weekend. During various useful summers, my grandparents and then my mother and father had the use of the North Cottage. Grandmother and grandfather lived there during the summer that Wendover was being readied, being rebuilt and readied for them. And then my father and mother had the North Cottage for 3 years, and at least I like to think it was four, but I think it was really only three. And I had those summers of my early childhood from about six. I would say I was about five or six when we first were there. And in that magic landscape, my love for these mountains was formed. We're almost ready for the pictures. In 1928, William and Harriet bought Wendover. It was scouted out for them by Harry Armstrong, Uncle Harry. They found the land, an old broken down farm. The reason that grandfather had asked Harry Armstrong to do this was because, of course, if he, the ministerial mouse of the family, had gone, they would still have heard his last name and upped the price, undoubtedly. At any rate, it was along the country road between Fox Lair and the hamlets of Johnsburg and Weavertown. And it had a mill, an old forgotten mill. It had a barn. It had a dam. But the dam had been let out so that the woman who owned the house could perhaps farm that area that had been what was called Roth's Lake. It's on the old maps as Roth's Lake. At any rate, the woman who owned it had it as a rooming house for hunters and fishermen. And so my Uncle Bill, who was a young man, and he wrote a letter to my cousin Bob Bischoff's mother to say, it's a pretty good property, and Dad thinks we'll probably buy it. And so Dad did buy it, and luckily just before the crash. And the story is that if it had been about a week later, the inheritance that he had bought it with from his mother would have been nothing, worth nothing. So we've always felt that Wendover was pretty much of a magic present to us all. At any rate, the derelict house was restored by an architect friend of grandfather's. The small lake, known then as Roth Lake, was dammed and enlarged. And building and expanding this family gathering place has been the story of our life in many ways, and our grandparents' finest purpose. That's my opinion. As for Fox Lair, Aunt Winifred gave it to the Police Athletic League of New York City to be a camp for poor boys from New York. The PAL owned it from 1938 to 1964, and while many police officers supervised these sessions, living in the chauffeur's house and the North Cottage, Roy Dunkley, of a well-known family in our parts, was caretaker of the camp, and the Armstrongs moved into North Creek. During those years, thousands of boys from the sidewalks of New York came there for periods of 2 weeks camping. Pete Hamill, the writer, came and wrote about it in one of his books, and I can tell you, I don't quote from that. Naturally, the buildings were greatly changed. Bunk beds, 20 bunk beds, sleeping 40 boys, crowded into the master bedroom of that Aunt Winifred had decorated, and that Aunt Evelyn had lived
this
in.
This is a picture of Richard.
And the next picture is of grandfather, and they're both taken, both at the same, relatively same time in their lives. They're young. Richard, you see Richard's bright blue eyes and his architectural beard, and it is the very picture of a very successful creator in many ways. And the one thing that I found out was that exquisite skills were necessary to create perfume in this country. And the number of things that are shown in a kind of a dictionary of American business leadership of that time made me truly respect Uncle Richard's know-how and his immense entrepreneurial skill. Oh dear, you see, I just pushed the wrong one. Oh, that's, well, I lost grandfather. Now, I think I, there. Thank you, Carolyn. Anyway, he's such a lovely man, and he has rather than those very icy blue eyes, he has very warm, wonderful brown eyes, and just look at that mustache. So, and that doesn't seem to fit his character, but at any rate, there he is. Probably, oh, I believe that he and grandmother had their pictures taken at the time of their wedding. This is the first house that Alexander Hudnut built. It's clearly done before all of its landscaping, because of the landscaping made it really much more beautiful. This was built at the time when people were becoming enamored of the Italianate form. People were traveling a great deal before the Civil War, and they were learning what it was like to have a Tuscan tower. And so my great-grandfather decided that he wanted to have one, and they lived in this for Richard's boyhood. And Richard was a young man in the days here, and grandfather's youngest, his happiest boyhood was spent in this house. It was a kind of a pink stucco, and it was in Llewellyn Park in East Orange, or West Orange, I'm not sure. I never get the oranges exactly clear. And this is the next house that my grandfather built, my great-grandfather built. Alexander, he liked making a show place, and I believe that this is what is a Queen Anne architectural folly. At any rate, this is where he lived after Arcadia. And this is the porte cochere, and there underneath Alexander, you can't see him unfortunately, but he's there somewhere. He's there, right there, and he has a very elegant sort of gray top hat. And this is Rhody, the coachman, and they're about to go off, I believe, to the train, which will take him to his office.
Where was that house?
Pardon?
Where was that house?
Oh, that was in West Orange. That was about three, four acres right in the main part of West Orange of those days.
Okay. Well, not Llewellyn Park.
Mm-hmm. Not Llewellyn Park.
No, Llewellyn Park was the the first one, and the next door neighbor, the house next that was built next to my great grandfather's house in Llewellyn Park was Thomas Edison's. Mm-hmm. Now this is the picture I told you about of grandfather at what it's easier to say the Northwoods Club, even though it wasn't then, and there he is playing the violin. And this might be Eliphalet Terry with the hat on the left-hand side. And on the right, lying down, is Bob Bibby, the sort of patron saint of the Northwoods Club for many years, the manager, the person who ran it. And that is one of his children. This is the home of Marie Sinclair, Marie Marvin Sinclair. a cousin up on the Beecher side of our family, and the great patroness of the family that my aunt Kit Bischoff married into. So my Bischoff cousins are very much related to this part of the family. And cousin Lucy brought my great grandparents to Fish House, back to Fish House, which is a very much of a family place. After my great grandfather Beecher lost his beautiful farm near Elmira in the depression of something like 1879 or something of that sort. At any rate, the house, you can see that there's a little house behind Cousin Lucy's house, and that house is where my great-grandparents, were given a homestead until later on when they had their own home. And that house is notable for me because it is said to have been built on the exact same spot where Sir William Johnson's fishing camp had been. This picture, I know, doesn't have an awful lot to do with it, but I think it creates the mood of Fish House in that period. Cousin Lucy there with her parasol, a nursemaid behind with somebody's baby, great aunt Nan Beecher back there, 6 feet tall, and all these young people looking just like a painting out of the French country day, Sunday afternoon. And there's the Sacandaga wandering by, and Cousin Lucy's farms, as far as the eye can see. So that's why that picture's there. Because Fish House was a greatly beloved part of grandfather and grandmother's family life. And this was the old Beecher house, and some of the, that may be my father or Bob's mother standing there beside great-grandmother Beecher.
Is that house still standing?
Yes, but in a very deplorable state. Oh. Now, the great pride and joy of Fish House, and one of the many things, and I should say that house is still standing, but Cousin Lucy Sinclair's beautiful big house on the green that you saw was a victim of the Sacandaga Reservoir and was just buried, drowned, and as was this wonderful two-lane bridge, which was the pride and joy of Fish House. It had been built by the legislature back in, I think, 1816, something like that, and the person who brought it to the legislature was the legislator Jacob Shue, whom we're all descended from directly, just as we are from Godfrey Shue, who was the founder of Fish House Village. And this is just a view of the inside of the Fish House Bridge. It's really quite marvelously built. And Aunt Kit told me that on hot afternoons they would love to ride their bicycles through the bridge because it was the only cool place to find. Those Fish House days always seemed very idyllic to me, with tennis on the lawn and tea parties and costume parties for the young married ones or unmarried, and they had very happy times there, even though grandfather did escape to go up to camp Perkins, and which it just happens to come on. That is Camp Perkins. It simply doesn't look like the marvelous place that it was in the stories from grandfather and dad, but it was a marvelous place, and you can see the table that's set for all those people who are going to come for a rousing camp-style dinner. And the people in that, the Isaiah Perkins and his family, I just had to show you because this is a very unusual picture, and Rose Perkins, one of the daughters, the middle one of the three girls, the front. Rose gave this to me, and I feel very privileged because they are an archetypal family in that area still. Isaiah, you know, big, strong character, and very diminutive Susie Perkins, that was everybody called Ma, and Rose Perkins, who was a dead shot. Dad said she could go out in the back when her mother said she needed two or three chickens for dinner, and with one shot could bring down each one. I don't mean that she brought three down with one shot, but one for each of the three. And my father fell deeply in love with her. And it didn't work out. His parents had a different idea. They wanted him to go to college, and so he had to go and lead a different life. But they remained friends to the end of their days.
What was hanging above their heads?
I was wondering if someone would ask, because I don't know what it is. It was something that grew there that was hanging. These are the guides of Speculator that we knew, but there were many more. Isaiah is there in the center with the deer over his shoulder. And this tall one, Pants Lawrence, was little Susie. He was little Susie's brother. And Susie's mother died when she was quite young. Her father, Marinus Lawrence, was by some known as the first citizen of Hamilton County. And he had this huge family to bring up, and Miss Susie, as she was called, became sort of the mother of all of these brothers. And most of them were